First Ladies of the Cold War, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Nancy Reagan's death brings back memories for Russians, too. They recall her counterpart, Soviet First Lady Raisa Gorbachev.
People still trot out this cliche of Raisa being this overbearing, bossy female and Gorbachev being a wussy guy who was at her beck and call, and that is the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed. Like, people do actually say that, which is hilarious.
Also, what America's political climate has in common with Europe's right now.
There's a rise of xenophobia. There's a return of ideas about economic isolationism and protectionism that we haven't seen in decades.
Plus, an all-female crew sets a long-distance record for Air India, and speaking of flying, monarch butterflies on the rebound in Mexico. It's all today on The World. Thank you for being here. I hope your week is off to a good start, because in a few minutes, we're going to hear from a journalist who wrote an opinion piece titled, This is How the West Ends. First, though, in the interest of not darkening the mood too much, I want to remind you of a time when many said the West and East could end but didn't, the Cold War. I want to focus on two women who are inextricably linked to the end of the Cold War. I'm speaking of Nancy Reagan, who died this weekend at the age of 94, and her late Soviet counterpart, Raisa Gorbachev, the wife of Mikhail Gorbachev. Writer Natalia Antonova is based in Moscow. She says Nancy and Raisa were never the best of friends.
They were both, in their own way, extremely powerful women, and two kind of alpha females in the same room don't necessarily get along with each other, or at least that is the popular view of it. Historic records thus suggest that they kind of got along on the surface, but there was always tension.
Yeah, so two alpha females at the end of the Cold War sounds like it could get nasty. Did they generally keep things pretty civil?
There was a famous incident in which Raisa did say that she was not impressed with the White House, that she didn't feel it was a home. She said it felt more like a museum, which Nancy took great, great offense at. And I think it just perfectly shows how Americans and Russians differ socially, because Americans expect their guests to be polite, whereas Russians feel that in a social setting, you have to be as honest as you can. Otherwise, you know, like, what's the use of pretending? Pretending is pretentious. Right. The kind of things that she said that Nancy was struck by and thought was rude. She wasn't necessarily trying to be rude. She was just being Russian.
Right. Well, it's often been the first lady who decorates the White House. So to call it a museum would have been a personal insult, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Some people have said that Nancy Reagan was a really important influence over her husband and his politics. She had her own causes that she championed as well, like the Just Say No to Drugs campaign. Raisa Gorbachev also was said to be very influential in her husband's rule administration. Was that unusual in Soviet politics?
For the Soviet Union, that was unusual. That is why she got a lot of flack. That is why Mikhail Gorbachev was often portrayed by his critics to be this kind of subservient, you know, beta male. I hate to use this alpha beta stuff, but people do kind of use it to describe them. Because at the time, of course, it was unusual for a woman, for a wife, to be as active and visible and opinionated as Raisa was. And I think people really use that against her. They also used it against her when she dressed up, when she tried to look stylish, which she pulled off really well. It was seen as something unbecoming of a Soviet woman, at least. Even today, even years after her death, people still routinely trot out this cliche of Raisa being this incredible, overbearing, bossy female and Gorbachev being a wussy guy who was at her beck and call, and that is the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed. Like, people do actually say that, which is hilarious.
Well, I mean, interestingly, that is one interpretation of Nancy Reagan that also seems to have stuck. It's not the only one, but there are some similarities there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say so. In Russia, at least, this is, and I find this really interesting. Women like Nancy, you know, there are a lot of stereotypes of American women in Russia that were seen as, once again, too bossy, too active. We don't know how to act feminine. We don't know how to dress feminine. But someone like Nancy, I think she was kind of, you know, she seemed very petite and very, very stylish and graceful. And I think a lot of people cut her quite a bit of slack as a result of that.
Natalia, any reaction in Moscow today to the death of Nancy Reagan?
It's been on all the news bulletins. I mean, people have been discussing it. I noticed online a lot of people have taken to discuss the Gorbachev era as well. It gives them the perfect excuse to remember those years. And of course, nowadays, you know, with Russia being in this stark opposition to the West, very much swung in the opposite anti-Western direction, the Gorbachev era is once again being treated as this, like, this nightmarish chapter in Russian history, and they let this huge, mighty country fall apart, and they couldn't stand up to the Reagans. But of course, the reality, the historic reality, was much more complicated than that.
So people want an excuse to remember the Gorbachev years?
To blame current problems on them. Of course, you know, because the Gorbachev years, they're basically being used as an excuse to talk about how Russia lost its way, how the Soviet Union lost its way. People are feeling really nostalgic for the years where they thought of themselves as a superpower. Because Gorbachev presided over the Soviet Union falling apart, a lot of these people can't help but transfer their frustrations with the current situation onto him and onto his wife. She was seen back then and today as sort of the uppity woman who really kind of guided her husband too much.
Writer Natalia Antonova in Moscow. Always great to speak with you, Natalia. Thanks.
Same here. Take care.
Now back to that article I mentioned a couple of minutes ago. It's called This Is How the West Ends. Anne Applebaum wrote it for the online magazine Slate. And one line really caught my eye. Anne writes, "We are 2 to 3 elections away from the end of NATO, the European Union, and maybe the end of the liberal world order as we know it." I asked Anne what she meant by that.
We're seeing in Europe, also in the United States, a number of very similar trends. We have politicians coming to power or gaining prominence who are opposed to free trade, who aren't very interested in international cooperation of the kind that we've had for so many years, and who no longer want to work together with other countries to achieve common goals. And because I'm seeing that in several different elections across several countries, if any of these elections goes the wrong way, that could be the end of international institutions that we've become accustomed to.
Just walk us through, like, one scenario of how you see this, because you're taking on Donald Trump, you're taking on Marine Le Pen, the far-right presidential candidate in France, not to mention the movement in the UK right now to back out of the EU.
Donald Trump, in his book, wrote about there is no European conflict which it's worth giving any American lives for. He also said, these troops that we keep in Europe, they're costing us millions annually. Why are we doing it? Simply those two statements alone are an indication that if he were president of the United States, he might be willing to contemplate the end of NATO. Because, of course, the NATO promise is that if one country is invaded, the others will defend it. If the United States is no longer willing to defend European countries, then NATO is no longer valuable. It's no longer an alliance that can be relied upon. And there are countries in Europe who are worried about being invaded, particularly in Eastern Europe. If Marine Le Pen comes to power in France, she's also said she would pull France out of NATO. She would pull France out of the European Union. She's not interested in economic cooperation with other countries, and she's against globalization. And so we have in two big elections the possibility that large countries will withdraw their cooperation from big institutions, and that will effectively put them to an end. The EU situation in Britain is a little bit different. Britain could withdraw from Europe and not bring the whole edifice crashing down. But it's also possible that if Britain withdraws, other countries will want to follow. And the EU also, in that sense, also ceases to exist. And I think the EU and NATO are intertwined in ways that most people don't usually acknowledge. So I think it's very easy for people to say, right, who cares about foreigners? Let's just concentrate on what we have at home, and to misunderstand what America's international involvement and America's position in the world brings even ordinary people in the United States.
So Donald Trump in the U.S., Marine Le Pen in France, the government in London is considering pulling out of the EU. Do you have any theories on why this is all happening at once on both sides of the Atlantic?
Yeah, I think in some ways, even though we all speak different languages and we have different political cultures, events in European countries and even across the Atlantic to the United States do affect one another. People do see what's happening overseas. They do take ideas. A few years ago, I wrote about a far-right party in Hungary, which had grown and become successful partly by copying the tactics of a far-right party in Austria. So there is a learning process that parties and people take from one another. I don't think it's coincidental that there's a rise in xenophobia across borders in Europe. I don't think it's coincidental that there's a rise in a desire for protectionism and a backlash against globalization in several parts of Europe. There's a similar economic climate across the continent and also in the United States. And I think they're emblematic of that.
And you think the legal and illegal immigration that's playing into this election is playing into life in the European Union right now?
Absolutely. Immigration is an absolutely central issue in Europe, including in countries where there is no immigration. There was just a rather extraordinary election in Slovakia, which doesn't have any Muslim immigrants at all. and the ruling party made its opposition to Muslim immigration a central part of its platform, the effect of which was that the ruling party's vote went down, but the far right's vote went way up. And so Slovakia has kind of neo-Nazi parties in its parliament now, which it didn't have before. And there's a frustration with the fear of Islamic radicalism, but I think it's also connected to a sense of our civilization declining or our civilization failing.
Anne Applebaum, a columnist with The Washington Post and Slate, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Before the break, just one more story for you. This one's about an Air India flight from New Delhi that touched down earlier today in San Francisco. Nothing too unusual with that, but Air India claims its flight was the world's longest all-women-operated and supported flight. Harpreet Singh is Air India's chief of flight safety, and she says this was Air India's way of celebrating International Women's Day.
What we wanted to do on International Women's Day is to do a landmark historic event where we can display that women can be equally good in any activity which is traditionally male-dominated. We've tried to have a complete all-woman show for this longest flight in history.
That 17-hour flight covered a distance of 9,000 miles, and it wasn't just the all-female crew in the cockpit. Singh says all the flight operations were managed by women.
We had a lady dispatcher, we had a lady doctor who did the breathalyzer check, we had the radio operator on VHF who was a lady, we had the ops control people who were ladies. I myself did the safety audit, made sure the ramp checks were done, the safety checks were carried out, and of course the cabin crew and the security staff also were ladies.
Singh says she squeezed in a quick conversation with the captains before they headed off for some nap time.
I did speak to the captains once they landed to get their initial reaction, and they were all extremely excited, very happy. They said that all the passengers on board applauded after the landing. I told them that keep Air India's flag high, India's flag high, and keep the flag of women high overall.
Singh says she hopes the Delhi to San Francisco flight will send a message, especially to one group in India, young girls.
This entire message is actually to encourage young girls who have dreams of getting into the skies and they feel it's too technical and this is something that only men do. It's a symbolism of women empowerment that every so-called male-dominated function can still be carried out by women safely and efficiently.
And that message seems to be getting some traction. According to India's aviation agency, the country now has nearly four times more women pilots than the global average. And Air India says it's scheduled 22 more flights with all-women crews for tomorrow, which is International Women's Day. As Singh put it, almost every Indian woman pilot will be in the sky. Up next, monarch butterflies on the rebound, and a bit later on the show, the frontman for a band from Ukraine could be conscripted to fight on the front lines at any time. Stay with us here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Some good news for monarch butterflies. Those easily identifiable black and orange-yellow migratory butterflies have been in trouble in recent years. They've been dying off due to habitat loss in North America. But this year, the number of monarchs hibernating in southern Mexico has rebounded. They're covering about 10 acres of forest this winter, up from just around 3 acres last winter. Jorge Ricards is Field Programs Director with the World Wildlife Fund Mexico. He joins me now from Mexico City. I assume this is good news, this rebound in monarchs, Jorge?
Yes, it is good news. As you mentioned earlier, we were very worried because we have been seeing for the last at least 6 or 7 years a decline in the monarch populations. And this year we are seeing this bump, which is good news, of course.
And so how do the numbers this year compare to, say, historic numbers before the decline in numbers of monarchs?
It's very similar to what we saw about 4 years ago, but it is still quite low compared to what we used to see approximately 10 or 12 years ago, where we would see at least 4 times this area covered by overwintering colonies. So it's still low, and we need to be aware of that. We cannot sing a victory yet, but it is good news, of course.
Okay, so there has been a bump. Why the increase this year?
Well, it's hard to tell. It might be a combination of variables. One might simply be the weather. The other is the result of all the work that has been done in Mexico, the United States, and Canada for a number of years now to bring back the colonies. In Mexico, halting illegal logging, in the U.S., planting milkweed and involving citizens. So I think it's a combination of factors.
So stopping logging, planting milkweed, those are the kinds of things that would bring those populations back?
Probably yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, it depends on where those things are done. Our concern in Mexico has been for the last 15 years to halt illegal logging because we did have a big problem several years ago. Now, 2 years ago, we literally halted it. In the U.S., building this milkweed corridor along the migration route is also something that has been done. And with new emphasis from all three governments, but also with very strong citizenship involved. And that's also a big factor.
And remind us why it is good news when we've got more monarch butterflies.
Well, because the migrating population is very unique. Together with the one that migrates on the western side of the U.S. down to California, it is one of the longest migrations in the insect world, and it's over 5,000 kilometers that this butterfly flies. And it's a very unique phenomenon, too, because it flies down on one generation, but it goes back north through four or five generations. So it's biologically a very unique migration. It's also iconic. It binds all three countries. And it's a symbol. It's a symbol of cooperation. So it is good news to see a rebound in the number of butterflies this year. And we're hoping that we will see, as years pass, a tendency to recover the numbers we used to see several years ago.
Jorge Ricards with the World Wildlife Fund Mexico. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's jump across the Atlantic now for a look at another big environmental challenge, one where things are not yet looking up. We're going to southern Africa, which is in the throes of its worst drought in decades, affecting millions of people across the region. And it's been really tough on small farmers and gardeners who depend on rain to help feed their families. Bobby Bascom has our story from Pretoria, South Africa.
In my little garden here in Pretoria, sprinklers automatically go off every morning at 8 on the dot. They're doing a good job. My cucumbers have outgrown their trellis. I can't keep up with all the spinach. And, as usual, mint and morning glories are trying to take over. Without the irrigation system, my garden would look very different. It would look more like my friend Mavis's garden. Mavis feeds cracked corn to chicks in front of her small cement house in the township of Mamelodi. She's in her early 50s and wears a colorful head wrap and a matching skirt every day because she says grannies shouldn't wear trousers. Mavis is a domestic worker. She cleans homes in neighborhoods like mine to support her 5 children and 7 grandchildren. Around the side of the house where they all live is a dusty patch of seedlings.
I put in cucumber because I like it. And it's so expensive at the shops. Green beans. And here I put the spinach. But I see it's not working. It's just this few here.
It's not working because South Africa is suffering through its worst drought in decades. It normally rains every afternoon here this time of year. You can practically set your watch to the 4 o'clock downpour. But this year, there's just more sun. The first of the seasonal rain should have come in October, but it didn't start raining this year till December, and then only sporadically. That's bad news for Mavis, who really counts on her garden.
You know, I have a budget. And then when it didn't rain, nothing grow up, and then I used my budget more. The children crying, hungry.
Her garden doesn't grow, and at the same time, the price of the staple food here in South Africa, a cornmeal called pap, has gone up by roughly 50%. The drought is partly responsible for that, too. It's been particularly bad in the country's breadbasket region. And the price of imported corn has gone up because of South Africa's weak currency. Other countries in the region are even worse off, especially Zimbabwe.
The harvest in April is likely to be extremely poor.
That's David Orr with the World Food Program in Johannesburg. Orr says there are almost 2.5 million people living with food insecurity in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's government has declared a state of disaster and hopes international donors will step in to help. Nearby, Malawi and Zambia have also been hard hit, and in Mozambique, the price of corn has nearly doubled. All told, roughly 14 million people across the region are affected. But David Orr says there are things governments can do to help.
Things like investing more in irrigation, in water conservation, using drought-resistant seeds.
Orr says countries in the region should even consider moving away from thirsty crops like corn to others that require a lot less water. He says it's especially important to do these things now. This drought is likely tied to the current global El Nino, a temporary event, but climate scientists predict that southern Africa will be hotter and drier in the future in general. For Mavis and Mamelodi, the ins and outs of El Nino and climate change may be a little abstract, but she knows something's wrong.
Yeah, I think it's change of weather, I don't know, because everything now is changing.
Since she was a girl, Mavis says, she's waited for the week-long soft rain known as Nedopi to plant her crops. Nedopi just didn't come this year. But she's holding out hope that her prayers for rain will still be answered.
I want the rain every day, every day. Even if it rains, I'm on the street, I'm still coming home, or I'm going to the work, I don't care. When it rains, we must say, thanks God, because you wash us. Then we'll be fresh.
For now, the government of South Africa seems to be taking the same approach. They've declined to declare a state of emergency like Zimbabwe and are hoping the late rains that have come will be enough to salvage this year's harvest. For The World, Bobby Bascom, Pretoria, South Africa.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. Many refugees now in Europe were students back home.
You cannot just let them live for the rest of their days on social welfare. Those people, they want to do something. They want to feel part of this society.
A program in Belgium helping refugees get their college degrees. That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For the next few minutes, we're going to look at the lives of refugees. You know, one of the hardest parts of being a refugee is deciding whether to become one in the first place.
What would I do? Would I take my passport? Would I take my son? Would I get out at the first moment? Or would you stay? Because it's your home and you just don't believe that your neighbors and towns and villages would turn on each other like this.
Journalist Janine DiGiovanni has been speaking with Syrians who decided not to flee, not right away anyway, and the high price they paid. We'll hear more from Janine in a bit, but first to the refugees who arrive safely in Europe. One of the big questions in Europe right now is how to get the refugees who are granted asylum quickly back to school or work. In Belgium, a Syrian academic is aiming to enroll between 100 and 200 refugees at VUB, the Free University of Brussels. The World's Jeb Sharp has our story.
When Mohamed Salman moved to Belgium to pursue a PhD in political science back in 2010, he had every intention of returning home to Syria. He was on a full scholarship from the Syrian government, after all.
The government in Syria, before the problem in Syria, it helped and gave a scholarship.
But then the war broke out, and as sanctions kicked in against the Syrian government, Salman's money dried up.
Financially, it was a really bad time for me, 2013. 2014, almost I don't have, sorry to say, 80 euro in my account.
80 euros is about $90 right now, and that kind of money doesn't last long in Brussels. But his professors weren't willing to abandon him. They scrounged up some grant money, gave him some teaching work, and encouraged him to finish his thesis within 6 to 9 months. He did it. And because he'd been in Belgium for 5 years by the time he finished, he was eligible to apply for citizenship, which he got. Now he heads up VUB's new program for refugee students. One big goal is simply to allow professionals fleeing war in countries like Syria and Iraq to reestablish their credentials in Belgium.
When they come, okay, I am engineer. I would like to work. Okay, that's good. From where your certificate or from Iraq? I'm sorry, they don't recognize this certificate.
It's a problem faced by immigrant professionals the world over. And it's a problem the Free University of Brussels doesn't want to see fester inside Belgium. Koen Van Abel coordinates the university's task force on refugees. He started by asking government officials how many of the refugees granted asylum might be eligible for higher education. It wasn't easy to find out.
They were very reluctant to give that data because it's interview information, which is quite confidential. So finally, I found somebody who was willing to give me some insight information. And so we found out that 23% of the people interviewed, when asked what did you do in your country of origin, they were saying, I was studying.
Van Abel was amazed and seized with a sense of urgency.
It's people between 18 and 25 years old. You cannot just let them live for the rest of their days on social welfare, which is well intended. But those people, they have ambition. Those people, they want to do something. They want to feel part of this society.
Not everyone thinks the way he does. Europe, just like the U.S., has its share of anti-immigrant, anti-refugee sentiment. But countries like Belgium are also desperate for skilled workers.
Saying we see people with engineer diploma, architect engineers, we see civil engineers, we see industrial engineers. Those people, they are valuable for the Belgian economic situation. At this time, there are vacancies for engineer which are open for the last 6 months. They don't find anybody.
And even without the economic argument, there's another reason to care about educating newcomers, says Van Abel. Belgium failed to integrate the children of its North African immigrants, leading to the ghettos and segregation blamed for helping to create terrorists.
So if we don't want to reproduce the same issue, I think today we have to focus on integrating those people. And for us, study is still the best way of integrating people into a society.
It's certainly a way to make people feel grateful. Van Abel's Syrian colleague, Mohamed Salman, is passionate about his homeland, but also about his new country, Belgium. And he knows that he too might have been trapped inside Syria as it disintegrated. He too might have had to make that treacherous journey across Europe, which is why he's only too happy to spend his days sifting through applications from refugees hoping to enroll on his campus.
They want to complete. So I am so happy to support this program because I saw myself in each one of them.
Salman knows his campus can't absorb all the refugees who want to finish their education. But offering places to a couple hundred come September is a start. He and his colleagues hope other universities in Belgium will follow suit. For the World, Jeb Sharp, Brussels.
You heard in Jeb's story that adapting to life in Europe is hard enough for Syrian refugees, but at least there's peace. Millions of Syrians never left the country. They still live in the grip of violence 5 years after the war began. A new book tells the stories of some of those people. It's called The Morning They Came For Us, and the author is journalist Janine DiGiovanni. She arrived in Damascus when the war was just a year old.
In those days, you could basically go to Damascus. It felt, it had this odd ambience of people waiting for war to begin. But at the same time, Marco, it's very strange, and I've always noticed this, they don't leave, or they try to hang on until the last possible moment. And you always wonder, or at least I always think, what would I do? Would I pick up? Would I take my passport? Would I take my son? Would I get out at the first moment? Or would you stay? Because it's your home, and you just don't believe that your neighbors and towns and villages would turn on each other like this.
I mean, these are some of the questions you get into, like what pushes people at a certain moment to decide to pick up and leave. I mean, these are some very personal stories you tell. What were you aiming to do with this kind of reportage? It's very personal, not kind of explanatory in a way.
Well, I just feel there's probably, you know, hundreds of thousands of Middle East analysts and Syrian analysts. And I could have written a book that was about that, you know, the grand strategy, the bigger picture. But for me, I think telling about a war is best told through the voices of other people, not me, not my story, the story that these people have to tell us about their country. It's their country. It's their story. It's their war.
I mean, the stories you tell are very disturbing. It's a kind of a catalog of pain and misery and sadness. Let me ask you, first of all, because you bring it up in the book, how do you know that the stories you're telling are in fact true?
very difficult. And there's one story about a man who was very brutally tortured in a way that I've never heard. It was so extreme that first I spent a long time with him. I saw his scars. I saw his medical records. I stayed with him a long time.
Which man is this?
This is Hussein. Who was basically, I don't know if I should give it away, but he was, it was more of a medical experiment. It was something out of the Nazi era. It was horrific what happened to him. He was basically, doctors performed surgery on him as a method of torture. His name was given to me by someone from Human Rights Watch, who I trust very much, first of all. Then after I saw him and I took my notes and I just was so horrified by what had happened to him that I went to two doctors, one who is Syrian-American but is an Alawite. Not that he sides with the regime in any way.
Because Bashar al-Assad
al-Assad is but because he's lived in America, he is Syrian, he's Alawite, and we went over the details with him. And I said, could this have happened? And he said, yes, it could have medically happened, but I don't think that's what happened. I think he probably had a medical condition and they were operating and they did not have anesthesia.
Right.
So it wasn't done as a method of torture, but as a method of helping this prisoner of war. So that was the first one. The second one was a doctor I know who's worked with torture victims. And I said, could this have happened? And he said, unfortunately, yes.
So given that a lot of the people you met would really benefit from living in a place that's peaceful, it's not going to be home. I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are as an American about the slow American response to taking in more refugees in this country from a place that the U.S. really had some handle in the way it is today.
Well, you know, as the daughter, my dad was 11 or 12 when he came to America from Italy. And, you know, built and his father was an anti-fascist mayor in a small town in southern Italy. So, you know, I'm the child of an immigrant. And I feel that, you know, America, isn't it our whole ethos? You know, ethos is based on liberty and tolerance and acceptance. And most of us come from somewhere else. There's very few Mayflower descendants. I find it really shocking when I turn on the TV and watch the Republican debates and hear what people say about human beings. I think it's been quite shameful. I think that we have responded in a very mediocre, nonchalant way, the same way that, for all my huge respect for President Obama, he put Syria on the back burner in a very deliberate way, and that has really opened the door to many, many major problems and destabilization in the entire region.
Journalist Janine DiGiovanni, author of The Morning They Came for Us about the Syrian Civil War. It'll be published here in May. Janine, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Our next story takes us to the U.S.-Mexico border. On the Mexican side are foreign factories called maquiladoras, many of them built by U.S. companies. These factories employ hundreds of thousands of workers. Those workers earn as little as $7 a day assembling things like computers, cars, and airplanes. But as demand for cheap labor rises and the value of the Mexican peso falls, workers are protesting the low pay and poor working conditions. Mónica Ortiz Uribe of station KJZZ reports from Ciudad Juárez.
Just after 4 p.m. on weekdays, a procession of repurposed American school buses moves through an outlying neighborhood in Ciudad Juárez. Workers in factory smocks file out and drift across desert lots littered with tumbleweeds and trash. They're headed home after working the morning shift at many of the city's 300 foreign-owned factories. Brenda Estrada comforts her infant daughter as she wakes from a nap. Estrada is a single mom who shares three concrete rooms with her two kids and younger brother. She keeps them warm by burning wood in a metal trash bin in the living room. A bundle of wood costs almost half her daily salary.
No, o sea, más bien uno sobrevive, no vive.
We don't live on our wages, she says. We just survive. For 7 years, Estrada assembled fiber optic cables for the American telecommunications company CommScope. Last fall, Estrada and other longtime workers in Juarez began asking CommScope for a raise.
Pues nosotros quisimos formar un sindicato independiente.
We started organizing ourselves into a union, Estrada says. Then we were fired. Close to 200 workers make the same claim. Now they're suing CommScope to get their jobs back. In a written statement, CommScope denies these claims, saying the company only fired 8 workers for violating work rules. Ultimately, the workers did establish a union, which got state approval in December. That's significant because factory unions are practically unheard of in Mexico's industrial north. More common are so-called paper unions, which are set up and largely controlled by the companies. Even after their initial victory, workers now face the challenge of negotiating with a multi-million dollar company. In the parking lot outside the state labor court, a few dozen CommScope workers meet with their attorney, Cuauhtémoc Estrada, after a hearing. This is something historic, Estrada says of the negotiations. 50 years ago, Juarez was the birthplace of the maquiladora, or foreign factory industry. That industry is now spread across Mexico and fuels $500 billion worth of trade between the U.S. and Mexico each year.
Businesses promote this region as an area of global competitiveness.
Kathleen Stout is a political science professor at the University of Texas at El Paso, where Juarez shantytowns are clearly visible from the edge of campus.
People need to unpack that phrase, global competitiveness, and understand what it really means. And it means a kind of competitiveness that is exercised on the backs of workers.
Hundreds of workers from at least 4 other factories in Juarez are also protesting working conditions, including forced overtime without extra pay, neglect of injured workers, and no sick leave. But their main complaint is salary. Wages in Mexico are now 40% cheaper than in China, once the low-cost mecca for manufacturing.
Ahí o pagas los recibos o comes.
You either pay the utility bills or you eat, says Ali López, a former worker at CommScope. Company executives, including the founder of CommScope, declined to be interviewed for this story. A former manager at a major factory in Juarez, who asked to remain anonymous, said, quote, executives fear speaking about unions more than the plague. Back at the parking lot outside the courthouse in Juarez, CommScope workers wrap up their meeting.
Nosotros no queremos que se vaya la empresa.
Cuauhtémoc Estrada, their attorney, says the workers don't want the company to leave. They generate jobs, he says. All they want is for the company to share its profit fairly and allow its workers to have a decent life. For The World, Monica Ortiz Uribe, Ciudad Juarez.
Coming up on The World, DACA Braca still rocks Ukraine and beyond, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The famous slogan of the Nike shoe company is, just do it. But Kenyan investigators are wondering if it should be, just bribe it. You see, for years, many top Kenyan runners wore the swoosh. But recently, a Chinese footwear company called Li Ning has tried to challenge Nike's dominance in Kenya. Both companies are now in the spotlight for questionable payments to those in charge of sponsorship in Kenya. It makes you think Nikes are the only footwear runners wear. Not so, says Tom Ratcliffe. He's a director of Kimbia. That's a sports agency that represents some of the top distance runners in the world.
It's interesting because Nike's been involved in their say for 20 years, and they've been sponsoring athletes for more than 20 years. So the up-and-coming athletes are often wearing hand-me-downs, things that were kind of current to Nike 10 years ago, and they've received them from other athletes and passed down and down and down. So if you go to, say, an E10, which is really kind of the hub of athletics in the Rift Valley, there will be, at the track on any given day, there may be 200 or 300 athletes wearing a variety of products, some Nike, some not Nike, but the Nike models would range from something, the latest models, to some that are 10 years old.
Are there still any Kenyan runners who wear no footwear? I know that was kind of a point of pride in East Africa back in the day.
Watching the junior championships, so that's under 20, many of the kids are racing without shoes. So, and certainly the kids, you know, walking along the streets, running on the streets, heading to school, many of them are barefoot. So, yeah, that's kind of, they've grown up without shoes and kind of continue. Most of the athletes would continue racing, at least, without shoes through, say, high school age. Many, if they haven't received from received a pair of shoes from friends or whatever.
We should make no mistake, though. It's not like it's Nike and Li Ning and Adidas or there's no shoes. I mean, I was in Kenya in December, and you go into even rural areas, you go to a supermarket like Nakumat, and they're selling running shoes there.
Right, yeah. I mean, certainly that's changed significantly, say, in the last 10 years. So when Nike first came into the country 20-plus years ago, places like Nakumat didn't exist.
Right.
So, Nike came when there was nothing on the ground. There were no stores selling Nike shoes.
What about this Chinese brand Li Ning? It's the first time I've ever heard of this shoe. You seen any Kenyan runners wearing Li Nings?
No. You know, Li Ning, you know, I think is quite a big brand in China, and I assume they want to reach a more global market. And to be at the Olympic Games with athletes wearing the brand, the Li Ning brand, obviously was something that they felt would be positive reflection on their brand.
You know, Tom, all this news comes after Kenyan running had to deal with a doping scandal involving marathon champions like Rita Jeptu. How does the running shoe scandal fit into the other news just dogging Kenyan athletics right now? And what does the future look like for Kenyan runners?
I think the current controversy has to do with the Kenyan Federation. And I think the Kenyan Federation for years has, they've ruled athletes with our iron fist, and athletes didn't have much of a voice. And I think the positive of this is I think the current athletes now are basically voicing the need for change. And I think in the end, it'll be a positive.
Tom Ratcliffe runs a sports agency, Kimbia, which represents some of the best distance runners in the world. Tom, great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally today, it was about 2 years ago when Vladimir Putin came out and said Russia had no plans to annex Crimea. 2 weeks later, Russia annexed Crimea. Remember that Crimea had been part of Ukraine, and many Ukrainians say it's still theirs. So it's a tough situation. For some Ukrainians, there is a dark and brooding acceptance of the annexation. Others who had never before felt great nationalism have been galvanized to become Ukrainian patriots. Ukrainian band Daka Braka is now perhaps the country's best-known cultural ambassadors. They played Coachella and Bonnaroo, singing in their native language to thousands who don't understand Ukrainian. Daka Braka's frontman and vocalist is Marko Galenyevich. He speaks for the whole band when he says he's angry about what happened in Crimea and what's still happening.
Ну, насправді, да, 2 роки тому відбулася анексія, але такі трагічні і тривожні.
Galenyevich tells me that the annexation of Crimea isn't just one action that happened 2 years ago. He says there's still a war going on in Ukraine. We're still living this. And he continues, this is a big tragedy for us and for people in Ukraine. With songs like Yagudku, Daka Braka is proud to be representatives of Ukraine right now. Since the showdown with Russia in eastern Ukraine in 2014, Daka Braka often brings a Ukrainian flag on stage with them, only to find that their audiences, wherever the band plays, have also brought their own Ukrainian flags.
People around the world offer their solidarity and support for us. And people in Ukraine see us as ambassadors of Ukraine to the world. It's a very big honor to represent Ukraine and to see that audience support.
You're of the age that you could be drafted for the army, correct?
No, ти у віці, коли тебе може призвати до армії. Yeah.
So, what kind of considerations does that give you when you're performing with an ensemble like Daka Braka, I mean, knowing that potentially they could call you up to join the military?
Of course, this war takes a big part of my mind, and a lot of friends, people close to us, have had their lives totally changed. They're in the army now. There are people who've died. So that's why it's big on my mind. But we have no other choice. If I have to go, then I will do it without any doubt.
So yes, Daka Braka have played Coachella, but I can't think of any other artists at big festivals in the West who are awaiting orders to be sent to the front lines of Crimea. Daka Braka closing things down for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.